Up next this morning on the Radio Zine, Maria Armudian of the Scholars Circle hosts a panel discussion on the truth about lying, and we will go to that right after this message.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Some scholars say that deception is ubiquitous and normal in all human interactions, that lying is useful and possibly even biological. Others suggest that there is a cost to lying, even for white lies. What is the truth about lying? We have three experts with us. Cicela Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, Secrets on the Ethics of Concealment and Revelation, and A Strategy for Peace, Human Values and the Threat of War. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and Hidden Conversations, An Introduction to Communicative Psychoanalysis. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. Two of you, you've argued that deception is essentially ubiquitous, possibly even natural, biological. Cicela Bach, you argue that while that may be so, it's rarely justifiable and has a cost. Maybe we should start by distinguishing the kinds of deception and lies and where they occur. Cicela Bach, what do we need to know to understand lying and deception?
There are so many different kinds that take place in so many different circumstances, but then there are some cases that come before the public that really reveal a great many of them. And I would say, for instance, President Clinton and all that was discussed about his deception and his various forms of lying and also probably his forms of self-deception, that was so interesting because people in the public had a chance to see a person saying one thing and then saying the opposite. We have Lance Armstrong, and he, to us scholars, I believe, perhaps I speak for all three of us, it's particularly interesting to hear his testimony about what went on, how ubiquitous it was indeed, how much he did, and how he regrets it, how he got into it. So I'm fascinated by that case.
And how he justified it as well.
How he justified it for a while.
David Livingston Smith.
There are a number of forms of deception, many of which we don't really tend to identify as deception. We call them tact, or when we deceive our children, we call it preserving the magic of childhood, and so on and so forth. So there are various descriptions that we use to soften the raw fact that we deceive one another a good deal of the time. A very important dimension here with regard to deception is, of course, the moral significance of deceptions. Deceptions are far more morally significant than others.
Such as?
Such as, well, the way you see this depends on the moral theory you're operating with, but of course, some deceptions are morally consequential, and those are not necessarily negatively morally consequential. So there are situations in which deception is morally obligatory. You know, it's something that we should do. We would be wrong if we were not lying and deceiving. And there are other situations in which deception is morally wrong, that it's destructive, it's hurtful, it's contrary to human flourishing.
Now, as I recall, one of you said that this is the paradoxical aspect of lying. Lies can damage, but so can truth. What do you think we need to know? Charles Ford?
Deception and self-deception are ubiquitous. To say that does not make it morally right, however. It's just merely a fact of life. And I should say not just of human life, but truly throughout the entire biological world. Now, again, in regards to whether it's right or wrong, that's an entirely different issue, and I can only speak from my own personal view, but that is that a deception that harms another person is morally wrong. And sometimes, I got this from Dr. Bach's writings, sometimes we lie supposedly to help another person, but what we're really doing is lying to kind of help ourselves so that we don't have to deal with the discomfort, such as a physician lying to a dying person. Is that really for the person who's dying who may actually wish the truth, or is it so that we don't feel so bad about it ourselves?
Cicely Bach, this is your bailiwick.
I certainly agree with Charles Ford that there is a lot of what we might call deception, though it could be a euphemism, going on even in the cellular world, so to speak, and certainly among animals. It's not the same as lying. Some people have argued that only human beings can really straight out lie. But then the question of lying to the dying, when I wrote my book, Lying, which actually came out in 1978, the first edition, it was common for doctors to lie, especially to dying patients and especially to those who had cancer. By now, and in part, maybe my book had something to do with it, American Medical Association has changed its rules, and it's very clear that people on the whole want to be told the truth. But then there is a way of telling the truth, and I think that is what Professor Smith was saying. Sometimes it can be very destructive to tell the truth in such a way, and doctors can do it. Oh, yes, you have cancer. Goodbye. I'm leaving now. That form of telling the truth is very destructive. That does not mean, though, that you have to lie. Instead, I argue in my book Secrets that there's a whole region of learning to understand people, learning how to speak to them, not lying, but at the same time caring about their response enough so that you don't tell the truth destructively.
I really scoured the literature to try to find research that spoke to perhaps there are certain realms where lying does not occur. From the other two scholars, it sounds like it really is ubiquitous throughout life. Is there something that I missed in the literature that shows there are certain areas of life where it doesn't occur?
Well, there certainly are areas where one can keep it to a minimum. And there, I think what Professor Smith mentioned, the questions of tact and magic of childhood, preserving that, etc. There are ways of speaking that I wouldn't call lying, actually, at all. For example, even, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Well, nobody expects you to tell about your recent medical problems. So I don't regard that as lying at all. Then I also think what Gandhi said was so important. He taught about and wrote about truthfulness and nonviolence. And he said that the way to start addressing those really is in one's personal life, to try to create regions with one's family, with one's friends, at one's work, where one really tries to cut down as much as possible on the various forms of deception.
We have this idea that this is ubiquitous not just in humanity, but in nature. Charles Ford, why is it in nature, and how useful is it, and does that mean that it has to be in humanity?
When we look at this from a biological perspective, essentially all animals, and there may be a few exceptions, but essentially all animals are either predators or prey. And therefore, the question becomes, how can you obtain a meal in order to live another day? Or how can you avoid being prey and therefore living another day? And so you have this continuous arms race between predator and prey of how can one outsmart the other in order to either get a meal or avoid being a meal. Now, to some extent, that happens with humans also. And very unfortunately, I would say, and perhaps more currently in our culture right now than when I was a child, there is an enormous amount of competition. And one of the ways that you can compete is, unfortunately, by deception. And that, again, I would emphasize, does not make it morally right and does not rationalize it. But it is a fact that that is one way that you can get ahead. Now, if you're caught, of course, then you have lost all that advantage, you've lost all that power, and you may be shunned by others.
So it is an act of manipulation in both the animal kingdom and in human relations.
If I can step in here, and this is Cicely Bach again, to say it certainly is true, for instance, that birds send deceptive signals. There are all kinds of things happening in the animal kingdom of just that nature. But of course, birds cannot stop to think about what might happen to me as a person with a conscience if I lie, and if I lie a lot. And that is why it's so interesting among human beings that on the whole, the ones who have been caught, as Professor Ford mentioned, regret very much that they got into it in the first place. And there are so many examples of how people just sometimes slip into something, and then they feel they have to protect the original lie, and they go on, and all of a sudden they can't get out. And then, on the whole, they do regret it, if you ask them. Not everybody. There are some people who are totally callous.
That actually brings up something that David Livingstone Smith has written about, which is the unconscious, conscious parts of the brain. Can you help us to understand this process?
There's a lot of hype about neuropsychology, but in fact, we don't have much of a clue of how neural processes result in mental processes or embodimental processes. But I don't think that's really what you're getting at. I think the issue here is how we represent the world to ourselves. And this really introduces a whole new dimension to this discussion. By and large, when we talk about lying and deception, we think of someone who knows, who is aware of what is true, and who intentionally misrepresents that truth to others for purposes of personal gain. But often it doesn't work that way. Often it's the case that we misrepresent the world to ourselves initially, and then broadcast that misrepresentation to others. As it happens, some of these misrepresentations to ourselves are self-serving. So we can, in this way, sort of be in bad faith in good faith. I think that's quite an important distinction between the sorts of deception that's consequent upon self-deception and the sort of deception which is intentional and strategic and calculated. And by the way, if we're looking at non-human organisms, it's not just animals. I mean, it's plants, it's even microorganisms that deceive. But of course, they don't deceive in this intentional fashion. Their deceptive properties are built into automatic behavioral routines or their morphology or so on and so forth.
Well, this brings up a couple of things that I'd like to go into. One, I believe, David Livingstone Smith, this was also in your work, and this pertained to how people self-deceive in order to remain happy. I believe you called it to remain mentally healthy, while depressed people tended to be more accurate. It made me wonder about the definition of mental health.
A lot of this sort of language is normative, moralizing language dressed up as medical language. We have these ideals of how people should be, and we call those healthy. And we have ideas about how people shouldn't be, and we call them sick. Our notions of mental health, well, it's been shown that they correlate to a significant degree to levels of self-deception. There's optimal self-deception. The world is a rough place. We're all going to die. Everyone we love is going to die. A lot of the world lives in misery, and we buy our clothes from companies that employ virtual slave labor and so on. There's a lot that we close our eyes to in order to maintain a certain sort of mental equilibrium. And we call that healthy.
Charles Ford, you've talked about these other aspects of self-deception, like false memory syndrome. What is that, and what are the consequences?
The false memory syndrome actually are memories that people have, I should say memories in quote, which have been suggested by other people, and then it becomes their belief. Many people are very suggestible, but all of us have this tendency to remember things differently each time we bring it back into consciousness. Now, when we sit down at the computer and we have a program such as Word and we type something in, and it'll ask us when we push save, do we want to save the original? Do we want it with the changes? unfortunately, our memory doesn't allow us to save the original. It always goes back in with all of the changes that occurred according to whatever emotional state we were in at the time that we had the memory return. This sounds complex. It's actually relatively simple and was beautifully explicated by Elizabeth Loftus, and it's what I call the malleability of memory. It's one of the dangers of psychotherapy, where someone can suddenly have memories of things that never occurred. I wanted to go back, though, and respond to something that Dr. Bach had said, that people who lie and are caught are often very regretful that they had lied. I'm not sure that I would agree with that in toto, and certainly many of the people that I see are very regretful. Yes, they're regretful that they got caught, not necessarily that they lost.
Absolutely, and certainly that is what Lance Armstrong said first, absolutely. And then he wished he hadn't done all that he had done, but you're quite right. Getting caught is one of the things that is not anticipated often by people who lie a lot, and yet that is distressing in the extreme.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about deception. We have three experts with us. Sissela Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, Secrets on the Ethics of Concealment and Revelation, and A Strategy for Peace, Human Values and the Threat of War. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and Hidden Conversations, An Introduction to Communicative Psychoanalysis. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Sissela Bach, let's bring you back in here. If, in fact, lying is commonplace, how do we build trust in relationships, in society, with our leaders, with our athletes?
Well, I would argue first that it's too easy to say lying is ubiquitous. We have, in this discussion, talked about various forms of self-deception, all kinds of sort of marginal states. And so I think it is easy, actually, for people to begin to think about drawing those distinctions and to think about themselves, the kind of person they would prefer to be. But here I just have to quote a wonderful statement by Bertrand Russell. This comes back to self-deception. Every man, wherever he goes, is encompassed by a cloud of comforting convictions which move with him like flies on a summer day. I would argue that that's probably true. That doesn't mean that we can't try to cut back and cut back and cut back. Of course, we will always have a certain amount of self-deception. I like the expression, I think, from Professor Smith, of misrepresenting ourselves to ourselves and misrepresenting our world to ourselves. But we can try to straighten that out a little bit and work at it. And here I see a big difference in research between, on the one hand, psychologists who tend to more or less dismiss some of the moral problems, not necessarily the psychologist speaking here, and on the other hand, philosophers who take much more seriously the idea of trying to be as honest as you can with yourself.
Is trust the basis of relationships, and is there a cost to these various forms of deception?
I do believe there is a great cost, and this again is something that people realize only when they've squandered trust. They have betrayed people, they have betrayed themselves, no longer can they be trusted, and so that indeed is something that they often recognize too late. But that's where I also want to bring in the two perspectives we have. On the one hand, there is the perspective we can completely understand of people who need to get along in the world, and they are going to often do so by lying, in part because they don't quite see the problems that they may get into, and they don't see in particular the damage it does to themselves and to the trust that they're held in. And you can see that in marriages, you can see it between parents and children, among friends. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is that of people who have been deceived and who know just what's meant by this idea of no longer trusting a person. So my suggestion in my book, Lying, was, and I still agree with that, we really need to share both of the perspectives. We need to think if we can, before we slip into an entire practice of lying, think of the perspective of those other people and what they will feel and whether they will trust us again.
I'd like to bring Charles Ford back in for a moment. What about this idea of cognitive dissonance? Does that come in when we deal with these various kinds of lies or deception?
At times when people lie, there really is that type of internal conflict where they are trying to hold two disparate facts or two disparate ideas in their mind at the same time. My perspective on lying and the way that I became interested in this is probably somewhat different from the two other guests on the show. And that is, I became fascinated with the phenomenon of pathological lying, of people who lied continuously even when it didn't serve them any useful purpose. And so I worked backwards from that. I worked backwards from the very pathological to try to see what that would tell us about normal, quotes normal people. I'm not sure anybody's completely normal. And what I had found is that those people with pathological lying are people that we might describe as having disorders of the self. That's kind of a technical term. Another way of describing it is saying they're very narcissistic people. And one of the characteristics of narcissistic people is that they have very little empathy towards others and often very little understanding of how others think and feel. And that's why I was trying to get to the idea that often these people don't have a great deal of conscience. They don't have a great deal of regret over what has occurred with lying because the world revolves around them anyway. Now, if all people had a sense of right and wrong that was internalized, and the primary value was their care about other people, then there would be a much greater level of trust and of honesty.
David Livingston Smith.
I think this is a slightly rosy picture. I mean, we're in the happy situation of primarily agreeing with one another, all three of us, but I do think this is a bit rosy. I think it would be actually quite nightmarish if people did not lie to one another on a regular and daily basis. Lying greases the wheels of social interaction. Now, I'm using lying in a very broad sense here. Some people want to confine lying to a very narrow, deliberate telling of untruth. I'm wanting to use it in a broader sense. You can call it deception, if you will. I think our lives depend on it. Our social lives depend on it, and our personal lives depend on a measure of self-deception. And as I mentioned before, there are situations in which lying is the morally right thing to do. Deception is the morally right thing to do. So I think we have to make a distinction between the sorts of deception that are necessary for us to find one another bearable, and indeed to trust one another to some degree, and the surplus deceptions. I think the surplus deceptions, that's what we find in cases like Bill Clinton and Lance Armstrong and so on, the unnecessary deceptions. And those are the ones we should really be especially concerned about.
Cicely Buck?
Step in here. The business of saying that we lie all the time, and I'm really in agreement with Professor Smith that that's a very, very broad definition. And it reminds me when my book Lying came out in 1978, Time magazine had an article which purported to have scholars saying that we lie hundreds of times. Everybody lies hundreds of times a day. Well, I wrote to Time and asked about those people and what are they talking about. Turned out that they were talking about such things as smiling to somebody that you see in the elevator, that all kinds of things to them seemed to be lying. And I think that it's extremely important as people think about deception and lying to try to sort out the different kinds, to notice that smiling is not lying, for instance. And that will help with coming to grips with this question of whether when lying might be acceptable. I would argue that that is very rare, but it can definitely happen when you're trying to save somebody's life, for instance.
I'd like to come back to that because I don't think it's obvious what a lie is and what a lie isn't. And we can give narrow definitions and broad definitions of it. I think there's some advantage to being rather liberal about what a lie is because we tend to self-servingly constrain lies to certain sorts of very deliberate
misrepresentations. And that kind of lets us off the hook.
Charles Ford?
We have a very complex subject which we can look at from multiple angles, and I think that it is not that anyone is right or wrong. I think we are just merely looking at the subject from different perspectives.
The one thing we did not talk about that I wanted to get into, the psychobiological aspect of deception. David Livingston Smith, is this something that you would like to do?
Sure. I mean, amongst non-human organisms, deception is so common, it's virtually universal. The organisms deceive by their behavioral routines, by their form, their morphology, by their coloration. It is really extraordinarily common. Even organisms without a nervous system, certain sorts of plants that deceive wasps and bees into pollinating them, it's very, very pervasive.
From the human neurobiological standpoint, we have learned a great deal over the last 15 years in terms of the functional neuroimaging of the brain. In other words, we can tell what parts of the brain are activated when a person tells the truth, and there's a difference when they are telling an untruth, and yet a different activation when they're withholding the truth. And basically what these findings are, without going into the details, are that it requires more brain activation to lie than it does to tell the truth.
I would wonder if that would be part of where the cognitive dissonance comes in.
Well, some people are very successful, however, in suppressing half of the conflict that would cause cognitive dissonance.
Well, let's leave it there then. Charles Ford, David Livingston Smith, and Cecilia Bach, thank you, all three of you, for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thanks to my both.
Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Cecilia Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.
And that concludes the Monday Morning Radio Zine. Coming up next, of course, is the Noontime Jamboree. Well, not quite next. That's coming up at noontime. And, in the meantime, we have the Noon Headlines. So listen to the Noon Headlines and then listen to the Noontime Jamboree. On KBOO Portland.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, April 13th, 2015. In local news, around 100 Portland residents gathered outside the Mexican consulate this morning to protest the failure of the Mexican government to bring justice to the families of 43 students who disappeared last September. The government has changed its story several times as to what happened to the students and what was the involvement of Mexican authorities. They blamed the disappearance on drug gangs, but witnesses said the students were taken by local police. In international news, four ex-contractors of the formerly named Blackwater Military Contracting Firm were sentenced this morning for crimes committed during the U.S. invasion of Iraq. 7 years ago, Nicholas Slatton, Evan Liberty, Dustin Hurd, and Paul Slew massacred 14 Iraqi civilians and injured many more in Nisou Square, Baghdad. Slatton faces life in prison, while the other three received no less than 30 years. The Blackwater Corporation continues to contract out security offers officers under the new name Academy. On Wednesday, Israeli police and soldiers with members of the Israeli Civil Administration removed 11 solar panels from Khan al-Ahmar, a Bedouin village close to occupied Jerusalem. The solar panels had only been installed for a few weeks by a donation from a local Palestinian NGO, Future for Palestine, to provide brief electricity to the residents. The Israeli government claimed the reason for the confiscation was an Israeli decision to ban construction in Khan al-Ahmar. The village is located at a strategically advantageous point between North and South West Bank. Analysts claim that this action is a part of a local, larger movement to displace the remaining Palestinian residents in order to connect the city of Ma'ale Adumim to Jerusalem. And that's it for the KBOO News at Noon. Tune in at 5 p.m. for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters right here in our Portland studios. For KBOO News, I'm Ken Yoshikawa.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the noontime jamboree. Come on, come on, come on, come on.
When the evening sun goes down, you will find me hanging round.